Robinhood Radio presents Your Health with osteopathic physician Dr. Kim Tripp, a show presented monthly on Robinhood Radio, discussing the challenges faced and the solutions that are available for keeping vital health and well-being throughout our lives. And now, here's Dr. Tripp.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Your Health with Dr. Kim Tripp, osteopathic physician. This is the health show created to bring you vital information and discussion of all sorts of health issues on your mind and in your life from the unique perspective of traditional osteopathic medicine. So first, as we always do for new listeners, let's clarify what osteopathic medicine means. Osteopathic medicine is practiced by fully licensed physicians in the United States with a DO degree, a Doctor of Osteopathic Medicine degree. Our practice is based on the essential relationship in all living things between structure and function. In other words, the natural interdependence between anatomy and physiology, or between the physics of the body and its chemistry. As osteopathic physicians, we use our comprehensive and precisely detailed knowledge of anatomy and physiology to promote health and healing in our patients. We work gently with our hands to help your body restore optimal function based on optimal structure. Our medical specialty is therefore called osteopathic manual medicine. We receive uniquely in-depth training in anatomy and physiology and their relationship within your body in the context of a full physician's medical training. Only U.S.-trained osteopaths are fully licensed physicians and have all of the current medical pharmacopoeia, nutritional science, and full medical training at our disposal. This means that your individual treatment may include a wide range of approaches, but will always be founded on our gentle hands-on work. We practice from the unique perspective of first looking for the health in our patients rather than merely finding illness and disease. Our practice has been especially effective for, but is not limited to, musculoskeletal and other structural issues, as well as chronic headache, gastrointestinal problems, post-concussion syndrome, sleep disturbance, allergies, and many other problems. We work together with you, the patient, to help you build health and vitality in your body, mind, and spirit as the solution for your health problems, rather than only treating the disease symptoms. So in the radio show, we tackle health issues from this point of view. What can we do to help you build your health and vitality in order to prevent and heal injuries and disease? And we do that by giving you some basic information about the problem to help you understand what's happening, as well as offer solutions and guidance for helping yourself to heal and stay healthy based on our clinical experience with patients in our practice. Before we get started on today's topic, let me just remind you that you can listen to all of our prior Your Health shows online at your convenience by going to Robinhood Radio's website, then the On Demand section, then scroll all the way down to the Your Health shows. Then you can click the individual show by topic. It's fantastic. Well, we've been on an adventure of exploring and understanding our own gastrointestinal system. We looked at what it is and how it works, the anatomy and the physiology, and we looked at how it's all regulated in a normal system. Here's a brief functional review of all that to start. Recall that we eat food that is chewed in our mouths and begins digestion through release of saliva from the oral salivary glands. We swallow the food into our esophagus, the food tube, at the back of our throats and avoid getting it into our airway through a complex coordination relying on the upper esophageal sphincter that opens to receive food and the epiglottis valve that closes off the adjacent trachea, our airway. The food moves down the esophagus through peristaltic waves and enters the stomach through the lower esophageal sphincter. Once in the stomach, acidic gastric juices are released and the stomach begins rhythmic contractions that mechanically and chemically break down the food mass into a mixture called chyme. The food passes from the stomach to the duodenum, the beginning of the 30 feet of coiled small intestine, where digestive juices from the pancreas and bile from the liver via the gallbladder further break down the chyme into readily absorbable compounds and nutrients. The chyme passes along the length of the small intestine through rhythmic contraction in the small intestine, where nutrients are absorbed into the blood for use. At the end of the small intestine, the remaining mass passes into the large intestine, i.e. the colon, and while in the colon, the water and any remaining nutrients are absorbed, and what is left is stool, which is stored in the rectum until it is voluntarily evacuated via the anus during a bowel movement. Overall, the GI system is regulated and coordinated through the check and balance interaction of neural signals from the various components of our nervous system and hormonal signals that stimulate different aspects of digestion and the gastrointestinal system and respond to changes such as chewing and swallowing, stretching of the gut wall after eating, and accumulation of stool. The gut hormones work in association with the gut's extensive nervous system, called the enteric nervous system, and play a coordinating role in the control of appetite, the digestion of food, the regulation of energy balance, and the maintenance of blood glucose levels. The gut continuously sends information to the brain regarding the quality and quantity of the food that is consumed. This coordination is amazingly and exquisitely fine-tuned to respond to not only the fact that we are eating, but what we are eating, and whether or not there are harmful materials or microbes in what we just ate. The gut produces more than 20 different signaling compounds that control things like increased or decreased appetite, acid secretion in the stomach, and immune cell stimulation. Our GI system is the largest immune organ in the body. Well, today, I want to go into more detail on the gut flora and then go over a few common GI problems and start to talk about how to get help for those problems. We'll continue on the list of problems in the next show as well. So let's talk about that gut flora. The gut microbiota is a crucial ecosystem within our bodies, consisting of anywhere from 400 to 1,000 different species of microbes, mostly bacteria, with the total number of individual bacterial organisms likely in the trillions, and altogether weighing as much as 3 pounds. That's a lot of beneficial bugs. These beneficial microbes assist us in many ways, including synthesizing essential nutrients like vitamin K, digesting fiber, and inhibiting the growth of harmful microbes. They are sparsely distributed in the stomach and small intestine, and richly distributed in the large intestine, the colon. Every person has a unique fingerprint of exactly which bacteria and how many of each bacteria reside in their gut. A newborn's gut is seeded at birth from their mother, and so the manner of birth, whether it's a C-section or a normal vaginal delivery, has a big impact on the character of that child's gut flora, and hence on the ongoing development of their immune system. We now also know that there is a direct relationship between our gut flora and our brains. Really? Yes, indeed. An increasing number of studies are demonstrating this direct link. Likely the best known human study on that gut-brain connection was done by Dr. Meyer at UCLA with healthy women, for a change. For 4 weeks, 12 of them ate a cup of commercially available yogurt twice a day, while the rest didn't. Yogurt, of course, contains live bacteria. In this case, it was strains of 4 species, Bifidobacterium, Streptococcus, Lactococcus, and Lactobacillus. Participants were given brain scans, functional MRIs to be precise, to gauge their response to a series of images of facial expressions like happiness, sadness, anger, etc., with or without the yogurt in their diet. The results, which were published in the professional clinical journal Gastroenterology in 2013, showed statistically significant differences between the two groups. The yogurt eaters reacted much more calmly to the images than the control group. The theory is that the bacteria in the yogurt changed the makeup of the participants' gut microbes and therefore produced compounds that modified the brain chemistry and responses. Amazing. Exactly how the microbiome interacts with the brain is still not a complete story, but many scientists agree that microbes probably influence the brain via multiple interactive mechanisms. Researchers have found that the gut flora produces neurotransmitters such as GABA, serotonin, and dopamine, which play a key role in mood regulation. Remember that some antidepressant drugs change levels of these same compounds. Some microbes also influence how people metabolize these compounds, effectively regulating the amount that circulates in the blood and brain. In another study, Dr. Cryan and others have also shown that some microbes can activate the vagus nerve, the primary autonomic neural connection between the gut and the brain. In addition, the gut flora is deeply engaged with the immune system, which itself influences mood and behavior. We don't have time in today's show to get into this fascinating subject more deeply, but we may in the future. But we all do need to realize that a healthy gut flora is an essential aspect of our whole health and well-being, which is why it is so important to be taking an appropriate, vital, probiotic supplement if we need to take antibiotics to control an infection, and in general, to be sure to include vital fermented foods in our diet. Fermented foods like sauerkraut, yogurt, kimchi, and miso are excellent dietary probiotics themselves that can help us maintain a healthy gut flora. All right, so now having all that background under our belts, let's move on to some common GI problems and what we might do to prevent and heal them. The GI system is a huge system, as I hope you're getting the sense of over these last few shows. So there are many things that can go awry. Conditions may range from mild and fleeting to very serious and life-threatening. Problems include esophagus and swallowing issues, such as esophageal stricture, which is a narrowing of the esophagus, gallstones or inflammation of the gallbladder, liver problems such as hepatitis B or hepatitis C, cirrhosis, liver failure, and autoimmune and alcoholic hepatitis, pancreatitis, which is inflammation of the pancreas, stomach issues like gastroesophageal reflux disease, GERD for short, peptic ulcer disease, or hiatal hernia, small or large intestinal problems such as polyps, cancer, infections such as small intestine bacterial overgrowth, celiac disease, which is a frank allergy to gluten, lactose intolerance, which is an inability to digest milk and milk products or other food sensitivities, Crohn's disease, irritable bowel syndrome with or without diarrhea, ulcerative colitis, diverticulitis, which is inflammation of the commonly occurring and normally inert diverticula of the intestine, which are the small outpouchings in the gut wall that we all get with age, malabsorption and associated malnutrition, and intestinal ischemia, where the blood flow to the intestine has been cut off, leading to the death of gut tissue, a kind of a heart attack of the gut. And lastly, rectal problems such as anal fissure, hemorrhoids, proctitis, or rectal prolapse. Yikes, that's an incredibly long list. Well, the first sign of problems in the digestive tract often includes one or more of the following symptoms. Obviously, belly pain, swallowing problems, heartburn, what we call acid reflux, nausea and or vomiting, bloating, constipation, diarrhea, red blood in the stool, which is from bleeding in the colon or rectum, black tarry stools, which is indicative of bleeding in the upper GI system, for example, in the stomach, incontinence of the bowel, and unintended weight gain or unintended weight loss. These symptoms can each be associated with one or more of the many potential problems we just talked about, which is why it is so very important to have any new gut symptoms evaluated right away by a physician, and in some cases, by a physician who was also a gastrointestinal specialist, which we call a gastroenterologist. Clinical tests for digestive problems often can include putting a small tube with a camera on one end down or up through the GI system while you are under sedation, in other words, scoping the gut. If scoping the colon, it's called colonoscopy. If scoping the upper GI system, it's called upper GI endoscopy. There is also a newer approach that involves swallowing a tiny encapsulated camera that is retrieved from the stool, and then its photographic journey is reviewed clinically. This is called, logically enough, capsule endoscopy. Ultrasound, CT scans, and less commonly MRIs may also be used to evaluate GI problems, generally with some sort of oral and/or IV contrast involved. Well, let's start going through some of these more common problems in more detail. We'll start today just by going through one. We're going to tackle GERD, gastroesophageal reflux disease, and we'll continue with the problems in the next show. So let's talk about GERD. Gastroesophageal reflux, also known as acid reflux, occurs when the stomach contents, which are very acidic, reflux or back up into the esophagus and or the mouth. Minor reflux is actually a normal process that occurs in healthy infants, children, and adults. Most episodes are very brief and they don't cause any symptoms or complications, and you're not even aware of it. In contrast, people with gastroesophageal reflux disease, GERD, experience bothersome symptoms as a result of the reflux. Symptoms can include heartburn, regurgitation, vomiting, and difficulty or pain with swallowing. The reflux of stomach acid can adversely affect the vocal cords, causing hoarseness, or it can even be inhaled into the lungs, which we call aspiration. Symptoms of GERD include stomach pain, non-burning chest pain, difficulty swallowing or food getting stuck when we try to swallow, painful swallowing, persistent laryngitis or hoarseness or sore throat, a chronic cough, new onset asthma or asthma only at night, regurgitation of foods and fluids, a taste of acid in the throat, a sense of a lump in the throat, worsening dental disease from the acid exposure, recurrent lung infections like pneumonia or chronic sinusitis with a cough or wheezing, and waking up with a choking sensation. You may have any or all of these symptoms if you have GERD. GERD can often be controlled with diet and lifestyle changes to include weight loss and avoidance of anti-inflammatory and high-acid foods. There are commonly prescribed medications for GERD called PPIs, which stands for proton pump inhibitors, and they have recently discovered very serious side effects, and they're difficult to come off of once started. So, except in unusual circumstances, they should be used as a last resort or a short-term measure only. Acid reflux is usually clinically diagnosed based on symptoms and the response to treatment. In people who have symptoms of acid reflux but no evidence of complications, treatment with lifestyle changes and in some cases one of these medications is often recommended without any specific testing. Specific testing is required only when the diagnosis is unclear or if there are more serious signs or symptoms as described above. It's important to rule out potentially life-threatening problems that can cause symptoms that are similar to those of GERD. This is particularly true with chest pain, since chest pain can also be a symptom of heart disease. When the symptoms are not life-threatening and the diagnosis of GERD is not clear, an upper endoscopy is commonly used to evaluate the esophagus. Damage to the lining of these structures can be evaluated, and a small sample of tissue, in other words, a biopsy, can be taken to determine the extent of the tissue damage. The vast majority of patients with GERD will not develop serious complications, particularly when reflux is treated. However, a number of serious complications can occur in patients with severe GERD as follows. You can get ulcers in the esophagus as a result of burning from the stomach acid. You can get an esophageal stricture. Damage from the acid can cause the esophagus to scar and narrow, causing a blockage that can cause food or pills to get stuck in the esophagus. You can get lung and throat problems. Some people reflux acid into the throat, causing inflammation of the vocal cords, a sore throat, or a hoarse voice. The acid can also be inhaled into the lungs and cause a type of pneumonia, in other words, aspiration pneumonia, or even asthma symptoms. Chronic acid reflux into the lungs may eventually cause permanent lung damage, which leads to pulmonary fibrosis or bronchiectasis. And lastly, Barrett's esophagus can occur. Barrett's esophagus occurs when the normal cells that line the lower esophagus are replaced in response to the constant exposure to the acid by a different cell type, in other words, by intestinal cells, due to the repeated damage to the esophageal lining, usually from GERD. The new cells have a small risk of transforming into cancer cells. People with Barrett's esophagus are therefore generally advised to have a periodic endoscopy to monitor for early warning signs of esophageal cancer. Well, those complications are very serious, but as I said, most GERD patients will not develop the serious complications, especially if it's treated. So how do we treat GERD? It's best to start with diet and lifestyle changes, including weight loss. Raise the head of the bed 6 to 8 inches, which raises the head and shoulders higher than the stomach, allowing gravity to help prevent acid from refluxing at night. Raising the head of the bed can be done with blocks of wood under the legs of the bed or a foam wedge under the mattress. Don't just use additional pillows. This can actually cause an unnatural bend in the body that increases pressure on the stomach, making the GERD worse. Avoid foods that promote acid reflux, including foods that also cause relaxation of that lower esophageal sphincter, thereby actually promoting acid reflux. Caffeine, chocolate, alcohol in any form, peppermint, and fatty foods may exacerbate GERD. Quit smoking. Saliva helps to neutralize refluxed acid, and smoking reduces the amount of saliva in the mouth and throat. Smoking also lowers the pressure in that lower esophageal sphincter. It provokes coughing, causing frequent episodes of acid reflux in the esophagus. Avoid large and late meals. Lying down with a full stomach may increase the risk of acid reflux. By eating 3 or more hours before bedtime, reflux may be reduced. In addition, eating smaller meals may prevent the stomach from becoming over-distended, which can cause GERD. Avoid tight-fitting clothing. At minimum, tight-fitting clothing can increase discomfort, but it may also actually increase pressure in the abdomen, forcing stomach contents into the esophagus. And there are over-the-counter and prescription medications to help with GERD, but use these with caution, as there are generally rebound reactions when you try to come off, meaning symptoms become severely exacerbated immediately after weaning off the medication, making it difficult to get off the meds, and there are many side effects. The two main classes of prescription drugs are histamine antagonists and those proton pump inhibitors, the PPIs, both of which lower acid content in the stomach, but through different physiological mechanisms. Patients with persistent or significant GERD symptoms and/or complications of GERD are generally prescribed a PPI. The long-term risks of PPIs may include an increased risk of serious gut infections, such as Clostridium difficile, the infamous C. diff. It can also lead to reduced absorption of minerals and nutrients like magnesium. It can lead to osteoporosis, heart disease, kidney disease, and even dementia. So use them with care. Surgical treatment may be considered in extreme cases. Although the outcome of surgery is usually helpful, there are also serious long-term complications that can come up. Now I'd actually like to talk a little bit about something called hiatal hernia. This is a structural anomaly that can create GERD and/or make GERD difficult to control. Recall that the diaphragm is a large flat muscle at the base of the lungs that contracts and relaxes as a person breathes in and out. The esophagus passes through an opening in the diaphragm called the diaphragmatic hiatus before it joins with the stomach. Normally, when the diaphragm contracts, it improves the strength of the lower esophageal sphincter, especially during added demand situations, such as with bending, coughing, or straining. But if there is a weakening in the diaphragm muscle at the hiatus, the stomach may be able to partially slip through the diaphragm into the chest cavity, forming a sliding hiatus hernia, i.e., part of the stomach slips through the opening in the diaphragm and becomes subject to being squeezed anytime the diaphragm shifts, therefore contributing to acid reflux back up the esophagus. The presence of a hiatus hernia makes acid reflux much more likely. A hiatus hernia is more common in people over age 50. Obesity and pregnancy are also contributing factors. The exact cause is unknown, but may be related to the loosening of the tissues around the diaphragm that occurs with advancing age. The hiatal hernia can come and go depending on various exacerbating factors like weight gain, deconditioning, stress, illness with a cough, smoking, constipation, dehydration, and others. Osteopathic treatment by an osteopathic manual medicine specialist can often lead to a big improvement and even complete resolution of a hiatal hernia, and therefore improvement and/or resolution of any associated GERD. The hands-on treatment can improve any chronic restriction in the motion of the diaphragm and the esophagus in the region of the hiatus. Which leads me to the close of today's show here with a reminder that a good osteopathic physician who is a specialist in osteopathic manual medicine can be particularly helpful for gastrointestinal issues of all kinds. Working gently with our hands with the involved organs, nerves, vasculature, fascias, capsules, and associated tissues to release restrictions in the physical tissues of the gut organs, the diaphragm, and blood and lymphatic flow, as well as to help with nutritional issues and support for whatever procedures you may be going through. Recall that all of the gastrointestinal tract is a complex physical entity with connections between all the parts that need to be open, flexible, and moving freely with excellent neural conduction from the cranial nerves, arterial and venous blood flow, and lymphatic drainage to remain healthy, vital, and functioning normally. Woo! Lots of information today. Next time, we'll move our exploration of the GI system forward by looking at a number of other common problems and how best to address them. But now, I've definitely run out of time again. Thank you so much for your attention to Your Health with Dr. Kim Tripp. Remember, you can email your comments and suggestions for topics to yourhealth@robinhoodradio.com. If you have a health issue yourself and you'd like to find out about how we might be able to help you in our practice of traditional osteopathy, we are at our offices in Sharon, Connecticut, Dr. Kim Tripp and Dr. Andrew Goldman, Goldman Tripp Osteopathic Healthcare, 860-364-5990, Monday to Friday, 8:45 a.m. to 5 p.m. with evening hours Wednesdays and Fridays, or on the web at www.goldmantripp.net. Meanwhile, I'll be looking forward to being with you next time, every other Friday at 12:30 and Sunday evenings at 5:30. Take care of yourself, enjoy your health, eat your sauerkraut, and thank you for listening.